So, welcome to session three to this month's masterclass entitled The Stunning Secrets of Covert Trances that will have you changing people's minds more often than you change your socks. Now, one of the things we've been focusing on in the last two sessions is really how to use trances covertly, how to anticipate them, and how to set a context in which you can use those in an elegant sort of way. And today we're going to have a real marathon session because we're going to take everything that you've learned so far and we're going to build it into a particular model of change called the Spirits Formula, which I'll dissect for you in a moment. Now, I'm going to invite you to remember or recall all the things that we've learned in the first few sessions because we're going to assume you know this stuff already and we're going to start building that into a very elegant model for covert conversational changes. Right. Things in particular to remember is the ABS formula for trance. Attention, bypass consciousness, stimulate the unconscious. Keep that in the back of your mind as a general blueprint through which you're going to run everything else. I'm going to assume that you're familiar with the internal fractionation method, particularly when it comes to the revivification stuff we did in the first session. I'm also going to assume that you have a reasonable grasp of the agreement reversal sets, particularly the doubt certainty pattern that we spent so much time on in the last session, getting the hang of. Because these are going to be the mechanisms that we're going to put into the Spirits Formula, which is going to allow you to create changes easily. Now, here are the questions that I'm going to present to you, and we're going to try and answer over the course of this session. The first thing is, how do we create elegant changes? And how do we do that covertly and conversationally? In other words, how do we do that in a way that's natural, given the context and the situation, and it's fluid, so it doesn't interrupt you, there's no breaks, it's just a natural part of the process. So people don't realize what's going on, they just respond in very powerful, very elegant, and very charming sort of ways. Now, in order to answer these questions, there are two rules that I want you to keep firmly in your minds. And these two rules are we're going to be using as the foundation of today's session. Rule number one is don't change people's minds, change their moods. If you want their minds changing, you want their behavior changing, change their mood and everything else will follow. That brings us on to rule number two. Rule number two is all behavior, and I mean all behavior, is state dependent. Now, if you change someone's mood, in other words, you change their state, not only do you change their minds, you change their behavior as well. And ultimately, as ethical influencers, you're in the business of changing people's minds and their behaviors. There's nothing else you could really want to influence. In order to be able to change either one of those things, you want to work on the level of state. Changing their moods. This is the key, crucial piece that we're going to talk about. Now, there are other ways to do this as well, and we'll talk about those maybe in other master classes, for example, strategies. But for this session, the simplest way to influence someone ethically, get behaviors and different results, is through their moods, through the state that you induce in someone. Now, we've already looked at two tools for those conversational changes, the internal fractionation method and the agreement reversal sets. Today, we're going to plug those into the Spirits Formula. But before we go into the Spirits Formula, I want to look at a more basic pattern, which we're going to then allow to grow naturally, the seed from which the Spirits Formula has grown. The most basic pattern for all change, and this is regardless of context, whether you're a coach, a therapist, whether you're a mentor, a business leader, an educator, a teacher of some sort, whether you are a salesperson, a negotiator, a lawyer in front of a jury, no matter what position you're in, the basic pattern for change is find the problem state, find a resource, and integrate the two. You find the problem, you find a resource, and you integrate the two. Now, when I talk about the problem, I'm talking about it in particularly in this session, exclusively in the context of a state. What is the state that drives the problem? What is the state that drives the problem? If you take the state away, the problem can no longer occur because there's no fuel driving it anymore. There's nothing that makes it happen or go anymore. So we're talking about state, we're talking about resource, we're talking about integration. SRI. Those are the three things you need to burn into your mind. That's the simplest, most basic pattern that all changes will go through. The state is the problem state. In other words, what is the state that drives the problem? The resource, of course, will also be at the level of states. Well, no matter what other resources you do in terms of skills, abilities, memories, whatever you want to call those, whatever you want to dredge up as a resource, ultimately it does not become a resource until you see a positive and useful state having been induced in the other person, and you actually see or hear them transforming, entering into those states. At that point, you integrate, you bring everything together, and you let the resource blow out the state that drives the problem. And now the resource state drives the behavior in a problem context, and the solutions flow naturally. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. Now, one of the things that we're going to be doing is take that basic formula, SRI, state, resource, integrate, state, resource, integrate, and we're going to just expand on that. So no matter how complex things might seem, always come back to this basic pattern, state, resource, integrate. Does that make sense, everyone, so far?
Yep.
Okay, so now let's recall one of the important lessons from the last two sessions, which is remember that the problem with problems is that the problem is not conscious. The conscious mind is not involved in that sequence. If the problem was a conscious one, if it was somehow consciously generated, then they would have changed the problem a long time ago. And this also includes, by the way, situations which aren't traditional coaching, therapeutic, etc. This talks about sales, relationships, negotiations, and those situations. The problems that stall a negotiations, the problem that inhibit someone who is looking for the kind of product that you have from actually buying it. Those are equally unconscious blockages that are preventing them to make the final step, make the final transition. Now, here's another thing that you should know, which is very often the solution that they're looking for also is the problem. Because the solution they're looking for is maintaining the conditions, which is allowing that stuck set of thinking inside their thinking to occur. So very often, you have to overcome the solution that they're trying to get to the problem. So what I mean by this, it sounds a bit strange, isn't it, to say you must overcome the solution to the problem in order to help them solve the problem. Well, here's the reason why solutions tend to get in the way of actually solving problems. Solutions are ego-driven. I mean ego in the sense that we talked about in the session on personal power. They're ego-driven, which means that the solutions people tend to find, particularly when they're stuck in a problem state, in a problem scenario, is a solution that tries to compensate for some kind of unmet need. When I talk about an unmet need, by the way, I mean a state, a feeling. So they're trying to compensate for an unmet need by trying to get a certain physical condition, a context, a car, a situation, a relationship of some sort, which they hope will then feed them that unmet need. But what they don't realize is that by doing this, they've actually put the cart before the horse, and they're making it harder for them to actually overcome the very problem and actually achieve the outcome, which is the meet the need that they want, because of the very context they've created. Here's a typical example. This is the formula that the solution problem tends to create. I need X before I can be Y, or I need X in order to be a Y kind of person. So here's a kind of example of that people might give you in everyday life. I need to have a fast car in order to be attractive to women. I need to have this job or job security in order to feel happy. I need to have a relationship in order to be happy. I need to pass this exam in order to be worthwhile or smarter or in some way more respectable. Now, you can plug anything into that situation. anything into the x and anything into the y. But this is something that people do over and over and over again. They create more problems for themselves by trying to attach the solution, which is the actual solution is the y, the state that they want, and they think they'll get it by achieving a certain physical context. Of course, what they don't realize is the truth is the reverse. You don't need x in order to be y. You will get x when you are y. When you are happy, it'll be easier to get that promotion. When you feel attractive, you'll be more attractive to the opposite sex. And then you might even find yourself getting a car because you put more attention onto your job, onto your work, so that you're less distracted by other things. You see, the solutions people are using very often are causing the distractions that are maintaining the situation or the problem. Now, our job is to get them away from the X part of that formulation. I need the car. I need this job. I need these walls to be staying the same color. I need a relationship. You need them to get them away from the fixation of the content of their solution, of the goal, and into the Y side of the equation, which is to say the state. What is the feeling that that will get them? Because that is where you can then use the tip, the chance of infinite possibilities, and that Y state will drive new solutions, better solutions. And very often, the very things that they wanted either become irrelevant, not such a big deal anymore. And sometimes they'll end up getting them completely by accident because they're not focusing on them anymore with such obsessiveness. So you have the SRI formula. The problem is the state, of course. The problem state. And the solution they're trying to achieve very often conditions more of the problem. Let's take the example of someone wants the car to feel more attractive. Let's say they're working really hard and they miss the promotion or they don't quite make the next sale. So when they don't get the sale, they know that they're not going to be able to buy the car because they don't have enough money. So they start feeling bad about the fact that they haven't made the sale because they're that much further away from meeting the need, which is to be attractive to other people and to feel like they're attractive to other people. And so they now take this negative state, this frustration, this being annoyed with themselves. They feed that into the next time they're trying to make a sale of some sort. And then the customers, of course, sense that. They don't like the atmosphere. The sale goes sour. They fail the second time. And it creates a recursive feedback loop. So the more they try and get that car, the more they want that car, the more they are training themselves to feel bad, the further away they get from the actual goal, which is to be attractive or to feel like an attractive human being. Do you see how that cycle runs through? This is one of the reasons why solutions often cause the problems or maintain the problems. Does it make sense, everyone?
Yeah.
It does. I had a thought about it.
Go ahead.
One of the things I come across regularly in doing therapy with people in particular is a kind of variation on this, which is an obsession with why. That the idea of why something occurred or something actually happened. And one of the things I kind of noticed about it, which is I think what you're talking about anyway, is you create paralysis, really.
I actually agree. It's the paralysis of analysis, I call it. And what tends to happen is people are now putting the Y becomes the X part of the equation. So excuse the phonological ambiguity there. They're saying, I need to know why I feel this way in order to be able to change. Now, what they actually want is to change. And what they don't realize is that sometimes all they need to do is to change, to feel better, and then they'll know why. This is my biggest criticism of psychoanalysis, which is to say, they think that if only they know why, then with that insight, change occurs naturally. My opinion is that that is the wrong way around. And that's partly based on, I think that they got the equation the wrong way around because they notice that very often when someone makes a change, it happens to be accompanied by an insight. It's almost like the unconscious mind releases repressed material and goes, oh, by the way, now that I don't have to protect you from this information anymore, here's why you are feeling so bad all the time. And people make the mistake of thinking that because insight can often follow the transformation, the personal change, that if only they can get to insight, that the change will follow again. And that's putting the cart before the very same horse. So you're absolutely right, David. It's exactly the same situation in a slightly specialist context. So the problem state, that's the S part of the SRI formula. The resource, of course, is the Y part that we've just been talking about, which is the positive state that they want to get towards. And finally, the I is to integrate, which is basically mix the two up together. Mix them up, shake it up well like a cocktail, and the resulting mixture will have enough of the starting position and enough of the actual unmet need, the actual state they're looking for a brand new construct to emerge, one in which they can be happy and have the car, the job, or whatever it is that they're looking for. Does that make sense to everyone? This is the basics of all covert influence. State, or the state that drives a problem, the resource state, mix the two together and let something wonderful emerge from that, if you like, soup. Now, an elegant way to create change is to create a context for change. When you create a context, of course, there are three things that are happening. You have an environment, you have a relationship, and you must engage in some kind of action which maintains that relationship. Now, you as the hypnotist are active in all those three parts of creating a context. You are part of the environment, you are the person they're relating with in order to create a relationship, and your actions, your behaviors, are the ones that are going to influence the other person, hopefully in a positive way, to make positive changes. So, here's a question for your conscious minds. What state, given that we're focusing on state because state drives everything else, what state do you, as a hypnotist, need to be in order to ethically influence other people in whatever context you need to do that? Be that therapy, be that coaching, be that sales, negotiation, teaching, whatever the context is. So, consciously, I want you to think about what state do you, as a hypnotist, need to be in order to ethically influence people more powerfully? Now, whatever you think might be the answer, already you'll realize that it's not quite the response you think it is. Because your unconscious mind can prepare you in so many different ways, searching through your memories, your experiences of ethically influencing others, and of having been influenced by others in a way that has improved your life in ways you could never have guessed beforehand. And as your unconscious mind reviews methodically and systematically all the experiences of ethical influences that you've had, you'll realize that you have inside you a perfect blueprint for the states that you need to find yourself in order to influence others elegantly, conversationally, covertly. And what a good thing to know that your unconscious mind can find these things now, because you can find yourself automatically accessing those states in the very situations where you need to have that ability to influence others. And you'll find yourself influencing others by the way you change your own feelings, your own moods, automatically, which means your unconscious mind is doing the work for you. And as you think about all these things, I'd like you to realize, just as an aside, that the ultimate way to create a context in which people will change conversationally, in which you can influence people ethically, is through your relationship. You see, when you have the right relationship, you go way beyond the need for any techniques. Your conversational changes become a fluid and natural part of the interaction that you're having with people, the way that you're just moving through the steps of interacting, so that you consciously are just having a chat, just talking, whilst unconsciously things begin to happen. Skills that you've developed over time begin to emerge as your natural communication style, inside of that relationship so that the other person stops having problems. They get unstuck. Often they'll get unstuck before they even realize that they might be getting stuck. Now, the question is, how do you get yourself to this point? Because whilst we're aiming to the point where you don't need techniques anymore, where you are free from techniques, techniques are useful training wheels to get you to that point. Because until you have the experiences of knowing what to look for, how to create the states, how to elicit the states, how to collapse the states, how to bring everything together in that sort of different formula. So, whilst your relationship allows you to create a context for someone to change, whilst you're using these techniques to get certain states and make certain things happen, the analogy I'd like you to use for this is that techniques or learning or practicing techniques is very much like being back at school and learning how to write. If you remember how you learn how to write, you had those funny little exercise books with three lines, and you knew that when you're learning or practicing your alphabet, all the capital letters had to go between the top and the bottommost lines. And you knew that the lowercase letters all had to go between the middle line and the bottom line, except some funny number, some funny letters like the P or the Q, which had to drop below the lowest line, or the Bs and the Ds, which had to go above the middle line. And as you were practicing your alphabet, moving between the right points on these lines, knowing exactly at what point to stop and what point to start, your hand was learning to write the letters of the alphabet. And much later in time, you began to put these letters together and make words. First, simple words like cat and mat and dog and apple. But as time went by, those words became increasingly sophisticated and complex, to the point where you no longer need to think about how to spell words anymore. All you need to do is have an intention inside your mind of expressing an idea in a visual format that we call writing. And your unconscious mind takes care of the rest. It moves your hand across that page and expresses that intention eloquently in the way that you write, in the way that you put the ideas down on paper. Now, you don't have to think about how to shape that little A anymore. You don't have to think about how to shape the B's and the C's and how to put them together. You don't even think about the spelling anymore. You're consciously only aware of the ideas that you're generating and allowing that to come straight, almost channeling through your arm onto the paper. This is how I'd like you to think of techniques. Techniques are those training wheels that allow you to find where is the topmost line, where is the bottom line, where is that middle line. Which point do I make myself go between which lines to achieve what effects? And once you've done this enough, once your unconscious mind understands the meta pattern behind the techniques, why the techniques do what they do, once you've learned enough techniques that you realize that really they're all doing the same thing, they're finding the state that drives a problem, they're finding resources and integrating the two, all techniques do this in some form or other. Then your unconscious mind takes you to the point what I like to call the point of wizardry, the point of magic, where you no longer need to consciously choose a particular technique. You just engage in a conversation, you intend certain outcomes to happen, and as if by magic, your unconscious mind eloquently and subtly changes your behavior, your communication style, in order to tease out the very things you want. In other words, to bring out certain states, to move between certain states, to break certain states, to break certain patterns. All these behaviors will now be inside you, a natural part of you, because you've taken the time to train them. Does this make sense to everyone?
It does.
Now, this is the key to making covert conversational changes, changes that where people will never even realize that it's happening. You become totally fluid and natural because you're part of a natural part of a system. That's when you create the most elegant context for change. Now, I want you to think about this as we go into talking about techniques and formulas and etc. Because yes, these things are all very, very useful and these are all very, very powerful, but ultimately you want to save yourself, you want to free yourself from the tyranny of techniques. Do you have any questions about what we've covered up to this point? Okay, I'll take that as a no. So now that we've covered the myth of techniques in terms of being stuck with them, I want to cover another myth, which is the instant success myth. This is part of marketing hype. I understand it. It's a natural way of doing things because, let's face it, we need marketing hype, otherwise we don't get students, and it's the way the world works. The downside, of course, is everyone looks for magic bullets. They want for instant solutions. They want things to work right now. And part of the problem with teaching something or teaching a particular model is that you're left with the impression that this model works every time perfectly, and if only you could make it work perfectly yourself, then everything would be fine. But let's face it, life isn't doesn't work that way. Do you know anything in life that is perfect, that works 100% of the time? Nothing. No rule works 100% of the time. Not even being nice to people works 100% of the time. Smiling doesn't work 100% of the time. So why should a technique work 100% of the time? What we're looking for is, I want you to start getting used to this idea that it's a myth that your techniques will work every single time. What you want to get used to instead is an iterative process. By iterative process is a process that gets closer and closer to the target each time it makes a correction. You want to get used to fractionating your results. So instead of saying, in martial arts, for example, in karate, there is a myth of the one punch, one kill, which is you have a fight, you hit someone once, it finishes the fight, it's done. It comes from the old samurai days when you had swords, where the sword could literally finish a fight in one blow. But even then, a lot of things would happen beforehand. And what I want you to think about in terms of using covert trances or conversational changes is the idea of fractionating results. Rather than thinking that you're going to have this sledgehammer that drives through whatever resistance, whatever problems, whatever things are there, and instantly get the result, that you're going to instead fractionate. You're going to be very smart. You're going to chip a little bit away here, a little bit away there, a little bit away here, and you're going to bounce in your fractionation between results until you absolutely get the result that you want. So what that allows you to do is it allows you to weave these patterns in natural conversations much more fluidly, because you're not wrapped up in the desperate desire to have results straight away. Remember, there's a desire to have results goes back to the solution is the problem thing we talked about, and it causes inside you the very problems, the very stuck states that you're trying to overcome with the techniques in the first place. So to bypass that, realize that it's just a question of fractionating results. I like the adage, wash, rinse, repeat. You do a particular technique, say. It doesn't quite work. Maybe it works a little bit, but they still have the problem, or they cycle back the problem in a slightly different way, or the problem evolves into something slightly different. It's like peeling layers of an onion. Those of you who are therapists or coaches will have noticed this, that when someone comes in with a problem and you start working on it a little bit, you do something, and they go, and you go, okay, problem solved. And go, well, actually, no, that wasn't the problem. This is the real problem. And you go, hang on a second, why didn't you say that in the first place? Well, part of the reason is that your initial piece of change work actually worked. You peeled one layer of the onion off, and there's another layer underneath. So rather than being disheartened, as I used to be as a novice coach, allow that to motivate you and realize, excellent, I'm making progress. You wash, rinse, repeat. You've done a little thing. It's either worked a little bit or it hasn't worked at all. Either way, you have more information. You wash your hands of that, you rinse, and then you repeat the process. And you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. This way, you eventually get to the outcome you want. Remember, the beauty of doing covert trances, the beauty of conversational changes, is that you cannot fail because nobody knows that you're doing it. So if a particular piece of conversational change doesn't work out, if a state you're trying to, for example, elicit and then set a trigger to so you can use it again, say you've elicited it, you've set a trigger, and some other state isn't strong enough, or you can't fire off the state again with your trigger, you're doing it covertly. No one knows you're doing it anyway. So how the hell are they going to know that you've failed? They don't even know you've started yet. So do you see the beauty of both using covert trances to create changes and also understanding that instant success is a myth, that is a solution that's causing you problems? And if you bypass the solution, you bypass a whole bunch of problems and you make your life a lot easier at the same time. Does that make sense, everyone, so far?
Yep.
I have a question about that, Igor.
Go ahead.
Maybe it may not be the right time to ask you, but I'm kind of fascinated by what you're saying. If, say, you're further down the road, and you use, I don't know, you use techniques like, for example, the I method, what would you actually do if, because I agree with you that instant success is not possible and that some of this involves the individual. What would you do? Would you actually leave somebody with techniques like the I method or not? Because it has an impact on potential success, if you see what I mean.
So, is the question then, would I then teach someone something like the I method, some kind of self-mastery, self-hypnosis, meditation kind of tool that they can take away with themselves in order
Yeah,
to help
pretty
them?
much so. I think what I'm trying to get at is how much of it is just from, if you like, your intervention, and how much of it is things that maybe people need to do on an ongoing basis to deal with life, for want of a better way of putting it.
Excellent. We're going to come on to part of the answer to that in a moment. So I'm going to give you half an answer for the moment, if I may. And if we haven't answered that completely by the end of the session, please do raise this question again. So the first part of the answer is to say that I would absolutely teach people things like the I method or self-hypnosis or something similar as part of an ongoing process because it gives them more ways of moving themselves forward under their own steam. The thing I like about the I method, and one of the reasons I designed it that way, is that it also has built into it this aversion to instant results. It's built into the saying, look, you have the quick fixes, and there are some quick fixes in the I method, which are taught explicitly as that. And there's the whole of your life thing. And the rest of the patterns, all the exercises in the I method, are designed so that you work on your whole life so that it becomes a wonderful, rich experience. Rather than saying, I have to get the car. What technique can I use to get the car? It gets away from all that. So that's the beauty of this. In terms of what you're teaching people, in terms of how you're shaping them over a period of time, let me pause up for a moment because that's a topic we're going to come on to right after the next topic. Okay?
Fine.
Any other comments or questions? That was a great comment, by the way, David. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Now, the reason, before we get into the actually very interesting question that David just raised there, I just want to draw your attention or draw together all the things that we've done so far to bring your attention to something that makes your life really, really easy is hypnotists, particularly as covert or conversational hypnotists, which is consciously, your job has become completely easy at this point. Consciously, you only do three things within a conversation that you want to use covert trances in. Consciously, all you do is you track the conversation, you keep track of what's happening. In other words, you've got to be aware. You can't have your mind floating off in space somewhere. You spot the states that are occurring, allowing your unconscious mind to, if you like, lift out or elicit the states you want or need as a result of your intention. You just spot the states that are arising as a result of your communication, your interaction. You use your signal recognition systems for that. And then you learn to apply the beneficial states back onto the states that drive the problem in order to solve this problem. Of course, that is the SRI formula all over again. Your problem state, your resource states, and your integration. And all you need to do consciously is think, track the conversation, where is it going? Spot the states as they arise naturally, and then just feed them back in, apply them to where you need them. And that is it. That's all your conscious mind needs to think of. That's easy. Your job has become so much easier now. The techniques, then, as we've already talked about, they train your unconscious mind to do its part of the job in that process. And the unconscious part of the job is to stimulate something to happen. You want to stimulate a fresh bunch of states occurring. How do you stimulate them? Well, that's what the various techniques are there for. Reification, confusion, agreement reversals, all these different things are there to stimulate some kind of change occurring so that you can use it and reapply it. Now, of course, initially, whilst you're still having those training wheels, you will consciously be applying the techniques in different settings. This is why I come back to what I recommended you do in session two, which is become people's coaches. Start coaching your friends, your family. If you're gonna get paid for being a coach, so much the better. Be a mentor of someone in school, be a mentor for someone in your business. Coach them, help them through things, and then use these techniques semi-overtly because the coaching context allows you to do that. And as you're doing that, you are gaining the reference experiences that your unconscious mind needs in order to be able to know, oh, I know, this is how you elicit states. This is how the whole thing fits together. This is how you do different things. So, if nothing else, the technique becomes the conscious distractor to allow your unconscious mind to get on with its job, which is really where the magic happens. Does this make sense to everyone? Okay, now let's get back onto David's question, which is about how do you, what happens in terms of what do you teach people over a period of time? This is what I call teaching trances, which is to say that I want you to be and to really understand this really clearly because this is very important, particularly when you want to talk about creating context for change, being the kind of hypnotist that wonderful things happen around without really too much effort on your part. Which is to say this, all relationships, all hypnosis, which is a specific kind of relationship, and all changes are essentially where you are training someone else to be a certain way. Every relationship you have, you're training the other person over a period of time to treat you in a certain way. And incidentally, if people aren't treating you the way that you want them to treat you, then that's partly your responsibility to change the way you're doing things so you're not training them to treat you that way anymore. All hypnosis is a training exercise. You're training people to go into trance to respond to you hypnotically. When we talk about hypnotic voices, and we talk about trance analogs, and we talk about triggers and personal trance words, these are all things that you train people to respond to so that you can use them, so they can be a certain way around you. On a bigger context, you're really training them by your own behavior to be a certain way, how to model your own way of being, how you deal with problems, how you deal with unexpected situations, how you deal with life in general. These are all things that you will influence other people with. And whenever you want to change someone, you want to help them make personal changes in their lives, you are essentially training them to one extent or another. A lot of therapists actually do this quite explicitly. They'll say to someone, okay, you must learn XYZ. And people who've been, for example, to psychoanalysts for many years become basically psychoanalysts themselves. They can tell you all about Freud's theories and the unconscious and what it means and all the rest of it. They might not have solved the problem, but they'd be very educated about the problem. Now, this is important because if you're going to be training people anyway, well, then you may as well train them to be something useful, to be in a useful state, to be in a useful way. And this is what I like to call formatting the unconscious mind. This is something that I came across for the very first time when I did my own NLP trainer's training. So I take my hat off to my mentor in the past, John Overdove, a phenomenal NLP trainer. He taught me basically, whenever you do a training, you want to format the unconscious mind so that before you even teach them anything, before you even go into any of the formal stuff, the mind has already lit up the neurological networks, the neural nets that will allow the behaviors and the responses that you need from them to come effortlessly, to come naturally. If you format people's unconscious minds as part of your covert trances, well then they'll change naturally, they'll change effortlessly. And I want you to remember this because this is going to be one of the keys, the setup, let's call it that setup, the way you format the unconscious mind is going to set up everything else that you do. If you do your setup correctly, then you can do a change just by pointing at someone saying, change now. Simple as that. If you do it incorrectly, no amount of techniques in the world will get the results that you're looking for, at least not reliably, not consistently. Now, I invite you to look at some other hypnotists who are great hypnotists. The early works of Grinder and Bandler, for example. You can get their books, Transformations, Frogs into Princes, etc., which are great because they're transcripts from their work. Milton Erickson's another great example. Look at any of the great hypnotists and look at what they did immediately before they did the magical change technique. And you'll notice that it's some form of training. They prepared the unconscious mind to respond in certain ways by setting expectations, by formatting it, by lighting up neural networks to make sure that the responses all go in a certain direction. And this is what you want to do as well. How do we format the unconscious mind? Well, you have lots of tools for this already. We've even covered them in specific masterclasses that focus entirely on these things. So you have stories, for example. Stories is one of my favorite ways of formatting the unconscious mind. And by the way, if you listen back on session one, I told you a couple of stories to prepare you for how we're going to be using all the materials all the way up to this session. Examples, or more specifically, hypnotic sets. If you remember back to the Hypnotic Power Loops masterclass, we talked about hypnotic sets, which again light up neural networks, which allows certain responses to be happen more spontaneously, more naturally. A revivification is another example of this. So when we did the internal fractionation in session one, that revivification exercise through questions can be used as a way of installing or formatting the unconscious mind to respond in certain ways later on when you need it. You can ask directed questions to make this happen. You can use pre-frames and presuppositions. In other words, you can set expectations right at the beginning. One of my favorite ways, something that I talk about over and over again, is you are the model. Whatever you exhibit, whatever you subcommunicate, will be the things that they will tend to actualize as well. So you need to go first as a hypnotist. You go into those states first. If you want someone to have a hallucination, well, it really helps if you have one too. And if not having one, you pretend to at least have one. You convince yourself you're having one. These are the important steps in order to prepare the unconscious mind to respond the way you want it to. So the most powerful examples are stories, hypnotic sets, revivifications, going first with your model, pre-frames and presuppositions, and that sets the context for change. That's the first part of the setup. So, what is the ultimate setup? What is the ultimate pre-frame that formats the unconscious mind? What is the one thing you can do in virtually any context that will allow you to format people's unconscious minds in a very beneficial way? Well, stories is one of these things. But I personally always like to use what's already there, use the content that's in people's minds. How do we do this? Well, I encourage you to get a big picture up front. Whatever context you're in, whatever situation you're in, get a big picture from the other person of what they want from the outcome. Now, when I say big picture, people think about goals and SMART goals or well-formed outcomes or whatever rules you have for setting goals. And these are all very useful. But ultimately, personally, I do not care. I don't give a hang for what the content of that big picture is. How much money they have, how many cars they have, how much respect they have. It doesn't really matter what the content is of that image. What I care about is the state. What state do they go into when they start describing the big picture, the thing that they want, their ideal outcome? Now, let me ask all of you this. Let me ask you this, and this is not a rhetorical question. If you ask someone what their big picture is, what their outcome is, they give you their big picture, but they do not light up. Their neural networks don't light up. What does that tell you?
It's not the right picture.
Thank you.
It's not the right goal.
Absolutely 100% right. It's not the right picture. It's not the right goal. What does that take you right back to? What does that remind you of? This reminds you of the solution is the problem. Because if they're giving you this picture, they think that this picture might give them something that might give them something that might possibly give them the fulfill the need they're looking for. You don't care for that content. You don't even care to reinforce that vicious circle, that cycle that is reinforcing the problem in the first place. What you care about, the only thing you care about, is the state that lights them up. And if the state, that if the outcome, the goal that they're giving you does not light them up, it's the wrong thing. You need to keep digging because you haven't found what you're looking for yet. Here's what big pictures give you. A genuine big picture gives you a sense of values. Those of you who are more familiar with NLP, values are those things that people find very important, like, you know, I want to have love in my life, or happiness, or money, or whatever it is. These things are tremendously important to people. Now, as a hypnotist, what is a value? Anyone care to express a value as a hypnotic phenomenon, or a something you can use as a hypnotist?
Happiness.
Okay, that's a value. So what is that an example of? If someone has happiness as a value, how might you be able to use that?
You could say, think of a time when you were really happy.
Okay, good. What about saying, well, let's bring some happiness into this room and use the same tonality as they do. If you use the word happiness with the same tonality as they do, what does that remind you of in terms of hypnotic technique? You should know this one if you've got the conversational hypnosis home study course.
You're mirroring their behavior?
Very close. Think about personal trance words. Do you recall personal trance words? So let me give you a quick refresher what I mean by personal trance words. Personal trance word is a word or phrase that someone uses, which is a trigger, personal trigger. It's keyed into a neurological network, which is jam-packed full of goodies. Sometimes you have a negative trance word, which is jam-packed full of baddies. But in terms of the resources we're looking for, values are personal trance words for resources. When someone tells you they really value happiness, there are two things going on there. Partly, that may actually be an unmet need. Otherwise, if it's a met need, it may not actually feature as a value. More importantly, it gives you a personal trance word. It gives you instantly a trigger, a button you can push to light up a whole bunch of resources inside them every single time. Not a bad thing to be getting out of just asking someone what they want or what the big picture is, right? So here's a question now. We want a big picture. We're looking for the big picture. I recommend that you always go for some kind of big picture right at the start, something that really lights people up. You want to get it right at the start because you want to get an untainted set of personal trance words for resources, for good states, a long time before any problem even crops up, even has a hint of peeping up. Because here's the thing. I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you do try this out. If you elicit someone's values whilst they're in a good state, and you put them into a bad state and you elicit their values again, guess what? The values change. The values will be different depending on what state they were in when you elicited their value set, because they become almost like a different person. Different things become important. When you feel bad, different things are important to you, which makes sense, of course, given all we know about state-dependent learning and state-dependent behavior. So don't wait to start trying to find resources until after they felt bad. Find a whole bunch of powerful resources before there's any hint of negativity. That way, if you never need to use them, you don't need to use them. Fantastic. But if you do need to use them, you already have a whole bunch of things ready to go, so that when you go back to researching for resources, it's a lot easier for you to do that. And you can actually start hinting at things and helping activate stuff by using personal trance words. Now, this is something that I recommend you do in all situations. Let me give you three different scenarios in which the big picture might actually work. And then I'm going to invite you guys to think about how you might use it in your own scenarios and give me examples just to make sure you're thinking along with the program. Let's say you're a negotiator. You're negotiating some kind of contract or a deal, maybe a salesperson. You come in and you say, excellent, we're here to do the negotiations. Thank you very much, everyone. You set the scene, etc. Then you say, before we begin this negotiations, let me say that again. Before we begin negotiating or these talks, I'd like to get a sense of what is it you want out of this? What are you trying to achieve? Okay? I don't want details. I don't want money. I don't want positions. All I want to know is, where do you want to be at the end of this day, this week, this month, or whatever it is of negotiations, assuming everything goes perfectly for you? Where would you be? Now, whilst they're giving you this, you're now listening out for personal trance words. You're listening out for the values that light them up. You don't care one jot for what the content is. They may ask for unreasonable things. You don't care. You care about what lights them up and what are the transwords that are lighting them up. What are the values that are hitting the states that you will need to use later on in the negotiation to get past the barriers, to get past the stuck thinking that doesn't allow things to move on. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. Igor, if so let's say you were chatting to somebody more casually, I would find it maybe awkward to say to them, what's the big picture sort of thing.
Sure. Now, it depends on what the context is. It's all about context, right? If you're just like hanging out with some friends, well, a great way to get big pictures is by going first. Remember the law of reciprocation? You are chatting about whatever it is you're chatting, then you share some kind of a dream or ambition, something you'd like to achieve, and you tell them in explicit detail how you'd feel if the world were this way or you achieved this thing or you made this thing come true. Now, tendency is that if you've done your job well and you've actually gone with this with enthusiasm and you've introduced it in a naturalistic style into the conversation, they will reciprocate. They will tell you, yeah, I'd love for this to happen. And they would be like this, and that would just be the nuts. It'd be just the nuts. Guess what? The nuts is now a key state. It's a key personal transword that you can throw in something else. If they go, it's awesome, it's fantastic, it'd be this, it'd be whatever. You now have that as part of a natural conversation. So in many ways, natural conversations are the easiest place to do this in because they don't have a precise focus. There's no need to get onto an agenda at that point. So you can steer it into any kind of way. And I personally like to use stories for this. Well, actually, I use stories and directionalized questions in order to draw those things out. And then remember, in terms of conversations, conversation, it's a lot easier because all you're doing is you're paying attention, you're tracking the conversation, and you're paying attention to when the states naturally pop out. Does that make sense to you, Sean?
Right, yeah. So anything that has got a lot of personal meaning to it.
Exactly. So a personal transword is basically...
That's really good, right, yeah.
It's just basically a word or a phrase that they lean on and maybe use repeatedly, and you notice that when they say this word or phrase, they light up. Somehow more energy gets jazzed into them. And then when you use the same word or phrase back at them, ideally in the same tonality, the tonality is a part of the trans word or phrase, they light up equally well, okay? Then you have it. And in normal conversation, in other words, a conversation that hasn't got a specific purpose like a negotiation would have, it's even easier because conversations go all over the place. So you just pay attention. You shape it a little bit by throwing in some of your own, by going first, and you notice what comes out. And all kinds of goodies come out at that point. Sometimes things come out that will totally surprise you. So in many ways, it's easier. Does that make sense to you, Sean? Does it give you an idea of how to use this in normal conversations?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay.